try that again. We ended last time as David and his growing group of political dissenters and socially disenfranchised Judahites rescued the food supply of the Judean city of Keilah from the Philistines. Now, the Philistines did not attack the city. They didn't attack the residents of Keilah. They just showed up in force to confiscate the harvest and the threshed grain for their own economic benefit. Now, an honest reading of the methods of the Philistines and other nations like them in that era reveals that many of them really weren't interested in acquiring land or building up empires. They just wanted food. They wanted wealth. They wanted sometimes steal people to build up their own nation. Most of them weren't bloodthirsty barbarians that enjoyed a good slaughter, or although some of them probably were of that ilk. Even the great Nebuchadnezzar, who would lead Babylon against Judah some 400 years after David's time, came to take the Jews' wealth and to take the most educated and able back with him to Babylon to use to elevate his nation. He didn't come to destroy. He came to confiscate. He wanted to build a modern empire. Destruction usually occurred as some type of a reprisal for a breach of a promise or for outright rebellion. With that, open your Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 23. We're going to start reading at verse 13. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it is page 324. 1 Samuel chapter 23, starting at verse 13. So David and his men, now around 600, got up and left Keilah and went wherever they could. It was told Saul that David had escaped from Keilah, so he called off the expedition. And David stayed in the desert strongholds, remaining in the hills of the Ziph desert. And Saul kept trying to find him, but God did not hand him over to him. Now David saw that Saul had mounted another expedition to seek his life, and David was then at Horesh in the Ziph desert. Jonathan, Saul's son, set out, and he went to David at Horesh to encourage him in God. And he said to him, "Don't be afraid, because my father's forces won't find you. You will be king over Israel, and I will be second to you. Saul, my father, knows this too." And then the two of them made a covenant in the presence of Adonai, after which David stayed at Horesh, and Jonathan returned home. The people of Ziph came to Saul in Gibeah and said, "David's hiding himself with us in the strongholds at Horesh on Hachelah Hill, south of Yeshmon. So now, king, since you've wanted so much to come down, come down. Our part will be to turn him over to you." And Saul said, "Oh, may Adonai bless you for showing me compassion. Please go make still more certain exactly where he is and who he is, who has seen him there, because I've been told he's very tricky. So look closely and find out where all of his hiding places are, and then come back when you're sure. Then I'll go with you. And if he's there in that territory, I'll search till I find him among all the thousands of Judah." Well, they set out and went to Ziph before Saul. But David and his men had gone on to the Maon desert in the Arabah south of Yeshimon. Saul and his men went searching for him. David was told, so that he came down to the rock and stayed in the Maon desert. And when Saul heard that, he pursued David in the Maon desert. And Saul went along one side of the mountain, while David and his men went along the other. David was hurrying to get away from Saul, while Saul and his men were trying to surround David and his men in order to capture them. But then a messenger came to Saul saying, "Hurry, come. The Philistines are invading the country." So Saul stopped chasing David and went to fight the Philistines. Therefore, they call that place Selah Hamachlot, Rock of Divisions. Now, no doubt, David and his men stayed in Keilah to guard against some type of Philistine reprisal against the people for thwarting taking of their grain. also probably to enjoy the comforts of city life for a few days after spending so long out in those caves and those camps. But when David got word that Saul learned of what had occurred in Keilah and that David and his men were staying at that walled city, he knew Saul was going to come after him. So his first thought was, would the leadership of the city of Keilah stand with David or simply turn him over to the Israelite king in order to avoid confrontation? The Lord, through the Urim and Thummim stones, now administered by Abiathar, unequivocally said, yes, the people of Keilah will turn David over to Saul. Now, with no remaining option, David led his men out of Keilah before Saul's expeditionary forces could arrive. He apparently moved from stronghold to stronghold out in this inhospitable desert terrain of Ziph in order to try and stay one step ahead of Saul. Now, stronghold is metzad in Hebrew. It is not usually indicating a fortress, but under rare circumstances it can. Rather, metzad or metzada is usually the high ground in the area that affords a vantage point from which you can observe the enemy. Or it offers maybe a hiding place or perhaps even some kind of natural defensive barrier. It makes it a lot more difficult to attack. Now, often these metzada had water supplies. By the way, notice that the name for that famous Dead Sea Plateau that scores of thousands of visitors ascend every year is Masada. Masada is merely a Roman way to pronounce the Hebrew word metzada. Fortress, high place. Now we're going to run across the term meaning wilderness, which is midbar, often in the Bible. And it generally means a desert. And particularly as it pertains to Canaan, and especially to Judah, wilderness means this vast Judean desert that is the Negev, down to the south, of course, of Judah. Ziph was not another desert. It gives us a more specific location within the Negev, the wilderness, the desert. Ziph was a town around 12 miles southeast of Keilah, about 5 miles southeast of Hebron. Therefore, the Ziph desert was the area that surrounded the town of Ziph. And the end of verse 14 makes it clear that Saul kept pursuing David, but it was the Lord who prevented him from finding David. The anti-king was not going to allow the harm to come to God's anointed king. Even so, Saul wasn't an inept man. He wasn't without resources, and soon he was going to find out David's whereabouts. Verse 15 says David was at Horesh, in the area of Ziph. Now, what it actually says is that David was at Ha-Horesh, which means the woods. And therefore, this merely means he was currently camped in some kind of a wooded area. Now, King Saul's son, Jonathan, upon hearing this news, hurried to find David and to warn him, but also to encourage David. Another way to look at it is that Jonathan came to reaffirm his commitment to David and to this covenant they'd made between them. Jonathan counseled David not to be afraid. I mean, David was, after all, human. He had been on the run for months. He had no interest in becoming a martyr. Nowhere in Canaan was truly safe. But David had been told by his prophet Gad that Jehovah set the limits of David's escape path to the territorial boundaries of the 12 tribes, or even more specifically to the southern areas that were controlled by the tribe of Judah. David was going to have to go forward in faith He was going to have to trust God completely. And David's Psalms show us that while he hoped for deliverance from Saul, he also realized that God could, in his divine sovereignty, well, he could decide on an outcome that David wouldn't welcome, like maybe his own capture, his own demise. Now, David was undoubtedly grateful for Saul, for Jonathan's arrival and for his words of encouragement. But these were not idle words of human sunshine spoken by David's dearest friend. Rather, what Jonathan said, he believed to his core. Jonathan told David, "Don't fear. Saul's military wasn't going to find David. They weren't going to capture him. And that David was destined to be the king of Israel. Nothing on earth was going to stop it." He told David that despite his father's actions, that Saul too now knew that David was God's anointed and the time of his reign was coming to an end. And it's at this point, I think, that David started to become self-aware that he was destined to be the king of Israel. He didn't deny it. He didn't deflect it when Jonathan spoke about it. Now, if we see this as a pattern, then it's not surprising that a full millennia into the future, David's descendant, Yeshua, Jesus, was a young man before he began to be self-aware of his destiny and who he was. And as we read the gospel accounts, it seems to portray that he only came to internalize and to truly accept his own divinity and his mission on earth, bit by bit over time. Jonathan reminded David that he considered himself second to you, meaning that while he expected to be second in command once David was king, that it would be David's dynasty to rule over Israel, not Saul's. So Jonathan would be strictly serving at David's pleasure. The Hebrew word for second in command is misne. It's the same word that we'll find in the book of Esther, in chapter 10:3, referring to Mordecai as the misne to King Xerxes. So it definitely carries the sense of being in an official position, not unlike Joseph when he was second in command to Pharaoh in Egypt. And we should note that Jonathan wasn't downcast about this. He wasn't passively upset at the concept of losing out on becoming the king of Israel or giving up all of his personal authority to David. Rather, he seemed kind of excited, pretty optimistic about what lay ahead with his dearest friend at the helm of the government. It was more a mature, realistic Jonathan that we see now. The Lord was about to bring in a new era, and Jonathan was less concerned about being in charge than being in harmony with all that God was getting ready to do. Now, sadly, Jonathan was correct, only in spirit, but not in letter. While David indeed would go on to become Israel's first true king, Jonathan would be second to him only in the abstract, because in the near future, Jonathan would die in battle at Gilboa alongside of his father, and David would be heartbroken over it. This exchange in 1 Samuel 23, when David and Jonathan meet, is the last time the two would ever see each other again. Now, I'm certain that many of you see the several wonderful lessons and the principles that are on display here. But the one that I'd like to comment on is this. The New Testament makes it clear that those who trust in Yeshua for salvation are his friends, and that we carry within us his great commission, his power to carry it out. But he is always first. We're second to him. Our future is tied to his, but his is much more important than ours. And we really need to keep that in mind. See, too much, the church has made an effort to make Yehovah a kindly, super tolerant grandfather in order that he's more appealing, and especially to the unwashed. Too much, we're told, that our personal desires and our welfare are his overriding concern. This is not true. Nowhere does the Bible establish that God puts us above all else. Rather, the Lord's own holiness comes first. His Messiah, Yeshua, immediately thereafter. The establishment of his kingdom, the kingdom of God, comes next, if those three are even separable. And then we as individual believers. Just as Jonathan realized and he wholeheartedly accepted his position in God's hierarchy as being subservient to God's anointed one, David, so we must, if we're going to fulfill our roles in redemptive history, understand we are subservient to Yeshua, who is subservient to the Father. That's the pecking order. And verse 19 explains that the people of Ziph, who were members, by the way, of the tribe of Judah, were even more antagonistic against David than those city dwellers in Keilah. It seems that they informed Saul that David and his men were hiding in their area. Now, perhaps they just didn't want trouble between them and King Saul. Certainly, they, along with everybody else, had heard that Saul murdered every one of God's priests at Nob from the mere suspicion that maybe they had helped out David. Or perhaps they just didn't want this gang of sorts to exist in their neighborhood. Either way, Saul was most grateful and genuinely touched for their display of loyalty to him. In fact, this spiritually irrational, self-delusional king actually calls on the God of Israel to bless the people of Ziph for what they've just done in turning in David. And Saul sees it as God showing compassion to him through the actions of the people of Ziph. These are the warmest words of praise that he speaks to the men of Ziph, ones that a king would usually not bestow upon his subjects. He actually thanks them for their compassion to him. The Hebrew word is chamal, chamal. And it means compassion in the sense of showing pity. This is very humble speech by King Saul. But Saul has sent his military on a wild goose chase so often, trying to find David, not realizing that Yehovah was the one who was orchestrating Saul's inability to find him, that he doesn't want to do it again. So he asks these Ziphites, please go back and double check exactly where David's whereabouts are, because David's a master of stealth. And sure enough, in God's providence, David and his men felt this unction, this need to move on from Ziph. They'd already left the area for the Maon Desert in the Arabah. Now, Maon is the modern-day Tel Ma'in, which is located about 8 miles south of Hebron. It sits atop a tall hill that gave David a commanding view of all the area around it. The Arabah is this barren stretch that basically follows along the Jordan River Rift Valley all the way down to the Red Sea. And David's men were not inside the village of Maon. They were in the desert area of its outskirts. And when David heard that Saul and his men were approaching, he again moved. Now, this time to a rocky area that he figured would make it pretty difficult for Saul's men to find him. And this area is strewn with caves, large, small. And as Saul's men inspected one cave, David's men would just move into another one, only to move back into the ones that they had just finished inspecting. It was kind of like an ancient game of whack-a-mole. You ever play that? Well, that was what was going on here, only it was a lot more deadly serious than that. Well, the king had received some good intelligence on this exact location of David and his militia. So he began to surround the area that he thought David was in, employing in a kind of a pincers movement on him. And Saul's army divided, and they began circling around from two sides of this rock crag where David was hiding. Well, David's trapped. I mean, Saul's move was brilliant. The king was as spiritually irrational as ever, but evil doesn't mean stupid, unfortunately. Just as Hitler overwhelmed Europe with brilliant battle tactics and superior weaponry that stunned the world, so Saul inherently knew just how to box David in. But David's fate wasn't in Saul's hands, and it wasn't in David's. In an impossible to orchestrate bit of timing, the Philistines at that moment decided to attack Israel. Just as Saul's men were ready to pounce on David, they had him. Undoubtedly, the Philistines had observed King Saul, Israel's commander in chief, once again leaving his country vulnerable as he set off with his army to pursue this one man, David. Messengers rushed to tell the king of this development, and frustrated yet again, Saul had no choice but to immediately halt his operation and rush back to defend his kingdom from the Philistines. But is this not how the Lord regularly works? In a never-ending series of divinely ordained coincidences, unsuspecting men, the righteous and the wicked, are accomplishing God's invisible will. David was miraculously delivered from certain capture and death because God was using the Philistines. As a result of this event, the place came to be called Selah Hamachalot, the crag or the rock of divisions. It was given this name in remembrance of that day that God put up a heavenly divide between David's men and Saul's men there in the rocky hills of Maon. Let's move on to 1 Samuel chapter 24. 1 Samuel chapter 24. Page 325, if you have a complete Jewish Bible. From there, David went up and lived in the strongholds of Ein Gedi. And when Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, he was told that David was in the desert at Ein Gedi. And Saul took 3,000 men chosen from all Israel and went searching for David and his men on the cliffs where the mountain goats are. Near some sheep pens along the way was a cave. Saul went inside to relieve himself. And it happened that David and his men were sitting in the recesses at the back of that cave. And David's men said to him, "Look, the day has come that Adonai told you about when he said to you, 'I'll turn your enemy over to you, and you'll do to him whatever seems good to you.'" Then David stole over unobserved and cut off the corner of Saul's cloak. But after doing this, David felt remorse over cutting Saul's garment, and he said to his men, "Adonai forbid that I should do such a thing to my Lord. Adonai's anointed has raised my hand against him. After all, he is Adonai's anointed." By saying this, David stopped his men and would not let them do anything to Saul. Saul got up, left the cave, and went on his way. Then David too got up and went outside the cave, where he called after Saul, "My lord, the king." And when Saul looked behind him, David bowed with his face to the ground. He prostrated himself. And David said to Saul, "Why do you listen to people who say David is out to harm you? Here, today, you've seen with your own eyes that Adonai put you in my power there in that cave. Some of my men said I should kill you, but I spared you. I said I won't raise my hand against my Lord because he's Adonai's anointed. Moreover, my father, look, here in my hand you see the corner of your cloak. By the fact that I only cut off a piece of your cloak and didn't kill you, you can see and understand I have no plan to do harm or to rebel. I haven't sinned against you, even though you are seeking every chance you get to take my life. May Adonai judge between you and me, and may Adonai avenge me on you, but I will not lay a hand on you. As the old saying has it, out of the wicked comes wickedness, but I will not lay a hand on you. The king of Israel has come on a campaign. After whom? Whom are you chasing? A dead dog? A single flea? Adonai be judge. Let him decide between you and me. May he take my side and rescue me from your power." And after David had finished speaking to Saul, Saul said, "Is that your voice, my son David?" And then Saul cried out and he wept. And he said to David, "You are more righteous than I, because you have treated me well while I have been treating you badly. You have made it clear to me today that you have done me good. For when Adonai put my fate in your hands, you didn't kill me. A man finds his enemy and lets him go unharmed. May Adonai reward you well for what you did to me today. Now I'm certain that you will indeed become king, and that the kingship of Israel will be established in your hands. So swear to me by Adonai that you will not kill my descendants after I die, or blot out my name from my father's family." And David swore to Saul, and Saul went home, but David and his men went back up to the stronghold. So David now moves his men to the area of En Gedi, a very difficult area to operate in militarily. En Gedi means the spring of the young goat, and it's located on the west bank of the Dead Sea. En Gedi was without doubt the most important and most permanent spring-fed oasis in Judah's vast desert wilderness. And for those who have ventured there with me, you know that in the midst of those sterile, ancient, rocky hills is this little bit of heaven that today is known as David's Falls. Almost any time of the day or the night, you'll see oryx and mountain goats and conies and these little small deer. Some of them have little goatees on them. Look like they're the males. It's practically a zoo of desert-dwelling creatures who are attracted to this green foliage and this abundant water that flows through it. Now, what's not apparent to most who come today, however, is that the Dead Sea that is perhaps a mile or more away from the approach to Ein Gedi was much closer in David's day. In fact, Ein Gedi in his day would have been waterfront property. 3,000 years ago, the Dead Sea, just as lifeless, by the way, then as it is now, was around twice today's size. Many of the better-known desert communities that we read about in the Bible, and we can visit them today, were actually built on the shores of the Dead Sea. Some Bibles will call it the Salt Sea. Jericho, Qumran, Ein Gedi, they were all adjacent to this vast pool of mineral water that would have also lapped up at the pathway that ancient fortress Masada. Now, the hills surrounding Ein Gedi are just peppered with caves. Locating David was going to be like finding a needle in a haystack. So we read in verse 3 that Saul assembled 3,000 men to go after David's 600. This was a search and destroy mission. It was a huge area. Small garrisons would be needed so that they could look in all these less likely hiding places to assure that David's men didn't simply vacate them as they saw troops coming and then just return to the same place when they left. See, there's this underlying theme to this chapter we need to recognize because it answers a very important fundamental question. Did David actively try to wrest the throne away from Saul? Did he try to take it from him by force? Now, for centuries, after this tradition was created and retold, and then later on it was written down, this was going to be a critical theological and practical point for the Jews. Because if David was just another would-be king who gathered an army of his tribal loyalists and overthrew a sitting king from another tribe, then his status as being the anointed of God would be questioned. And I hope you can see that. Politics was as important then as it is to us in our time. If making David the king over all Israel was perceived by future Israelites as an issue of replacing a northern tribal king, Saul of the tribe of Benjamin, with a southern tribal king, David of the tribe of Judah, then this wasn't really an act of God, as the tradition claims. It was just the result of typical human politics and the desire for power. And as Saul led his men in the search for David, the call of nature caused him to duck inside a nearby cave to relieve himself. Of all the places he could have chosen, wouldn't you just know, this was the cave where David and a lot of his men were hiding. Stunned at their good fortune, the men alert David, certain this has to be God that has handed Saul over to them to end this deadly game of cat and mouse for good. Verse 5 has David's men saying, "Look, look, that day has come that Adonai told you about when he said to you, 'I'll turn your enemy over to you.'" Now, first of all, there's nothing recorded of any such prediction that God made to David. And second, this may sound like a prophetic fulfillment, but it was really just rather customary Middle Eastern conversation. It's expressing the surprise that such an unexpected and serendipitous opportunity would just fall into their laps, and thus it can only be that God caused it. And this proves that he must be on their side. Middle Eastern banter was often couched using religious overtones, but nothing particularly spiritual was intended. So now we encounter one of the more famous stories in the entire Bible. David indeed saw this as an opportunity, but not as an opportunity to kill Saul or to acquire the throne. So while Saul is indisposed, David sneaks up behind him and carefully cuts off a piece of the hem of his skirt. Now, what was cut is in Hebrew, kanaf. It means the wings or the extremities of a garment. It carries with it a deeper meaning that varies a little bit with its context. In this case, kanaf is denoting the actual hem of the garment and not the nature of the garment. Back when we looked at Ruth, the story of Ruth, in that case, this act of Boaz spreading his kanaf over Ruth had a little bit different meaning. In either case, there's significance. It was customary that the hem of one's garment was symbolic of that person's station in life. The poorest had no hem whatsoever. The cloth was just cut, left to fray. The next class up wore a garment made of similar cloth as the poor, but it was folded over and sewn, forming a hem, so that it not only lasted longer, but it looked a little bit nicer, more finished. The wealthier had fancy hems, sewn with colored thread, maybe even some decorations on it. Kings and potentates had the most decorative, wide, expensive hems, since the more wealth one had, the more authority that person carried. The hem was a lot more than a decoration. It wasn't unlike the well-recognized stripes of rank sewn onto a soldier's uniform, or the various belt colors worn as signs of achievement by the various adherents of the various martial arts. At times, hems even took on a sacred overtone. So after David had cut off this piece of Saul's hem, he suddenly felt great pangs of remorse. He told his men he'd done a terrible thing, that he'd raised his hand against God's anointed. And David had shown no respect for the office of the king of Israel, and he committed a great insult against King Saul. Killing a person as they were doing their business, stealing from them as they relieved themselves, even looking upon them during such a time, well, that was just beyond indelicate, let's say. So much more was it for royalty. I mean, you just didn't do that. Not even to your worst enemy. David ordered that Saul wasn't to be further disturbed, let alone attacked or killed. And another God principle leaps off these pages for us. Not every opportunity that comes our way is of God. Not everything that would seem to give us great personal gain should we accept. Nor is it necessarily God-sent. However tempting, an open path to success that comes as the result of our own handiwork or at the time of our own choosing doesn't mean that it's necessarily in harmony with God's will. It's always necessary to examine God's principles and prayerfully seek God's purpose for whatever opportunities might come along in our lives. They could just as easily be a test of faith and discernment as an unmerited blessing. They could be a trap from the evil one. Have you ever found a wallet with a lot of money in it just at a time that you were in dire financial straits? You just finished praying for God's provision when you looked down. What are you going to think? There lies some stitched and folded leather with corners of green paper flapping up in the breeze. The person's driver's license is in it. They lived a long way away. How would anybody ever know if you just took that cash and then dropped the wallet with its credit cards into a post office drop box? Surely, God, this is your answer to my prayer. The person who lost it, I'll bet they're really well off. They don't need this. I mean, look at all this cash. Nobody but a rich person would have all that much cash in their wallet. They'll never miss it. What a marvelous gift at the moment I need it the most. Now, with this example I just gave you isn't very hard for you to judge. Many others aren't quite this apparent. David encountered just that kind of a situation. Saul's intent was to murder him, and David knew it. God's intent was for David to be Israel's king. What could possibly be wrong in killing Saul, in this case, and expediting the matter a little bit? Saul, the anti-king, being handed over to David, the righteous king, in such an unexpected, unlikely circumstance. Surely this was the moment that God had provided. But David inherently knew that murder on his part was not the answer. God hadn't told David he was to be the king. Other men had been telling him that. God certainly never told David to kill the current king, even though in some ways it certainly seemed justifiable. No, even though he and his men couldn't understand it at the time, it was not for Saul to die at the hand of David, or under the hand of any Israelite for that matter. Thus, the underlying and the critical theology and the practical question that I asked at the outset of this chapter, did David actually try to take that throne from Saul, has been answered. An opportunity to kill Saul, obviously arranged by God as a test. And immediately assume that throne. This was refused by David because he didn't view himself as Saul's enemy, nor as a person who sought to rule over Israel. That wasn't his ambition. This story would stand now as proof that David's rise to the throne wasn't by his own design, it wasn't by his own hand. It was a divine act of the will of the God of Israel, and David was simply an obedient servant to it. In verse 9, we have Saul leaving the cave, oblivious to what's been playing out, and David follows him at a safe distance. And outside, David then shouts at Saul, and he prostrates himself to show loyalty and humility, and he asks Saul, why are you listening to others telling you lies about me? Supposedly, Saul's counsel is telling him, David wants to kill you. Now, I don't know if David is contorting the reality simply to show deference to the king, or he honestly thinks that it was Saul's court that had convinced this poor, naive Saul of a great lie. Because what we read in Holy Scripture is the opposite of what David's saying. Saul's court, his military commanders, his own family, even the priesthood, they were all befuddled by Saul's insistence that David was an enemy of the state. This didn't make any sense to them. Such a position had much to do with his extermination of the priests at Nob. And David shows King Saul the piece of him he had cut from his royal garment. As a demonstration, he could have easily slain him. He chose not to do it. In fact, just as King Saul's men supposedly urged the king to kill David, this, of course, was a total fantasy, didn't happen, so did David's men urge David to take advantage of this opportunity and kill Saul. And indeed, that was the case. The contrast is obvious. Saul decided to take his men's advice, but David decided the opposite. Saul had no problem with the idea of murder. He committed plenty of it. David detested the thought. Saul had no regard for the throne of Israel as anything but his personal right, and his personal treasure belonged to him. David saw that throne as sacred, and its occupant is God anointed. So the stark differences between the natures of the anti-king and the righteous king just keep piling up, creating a pattern that is designed to help us discern when the man of lawlessness, that man who is predicted to come in the end times, the man of lawlessness who claims to be the Messiah finally makes his appearance. We'll continue with this next time.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.